Beginning in chapter 13, David immediately begins to reap in his own family the seed of sin which was sown earlier in chapter 11. Amnon is a wicked man, and as the oldest son, I believe that he thinks whatever he wants, he can have. We must keep in mind that these men are princes, because the father is a king. And as princes, they are spoiled, and they have been accustomed to whatever they want. We need not look too far in the world today to find similar situations among the wealthy and among the monarchs of the world. We know later on in 1 Kings that chapter 1 tells us that David had never rebuked Adonijah and had never asked him, "Why did you do this?" And I must believe that this method of parenthood prevailed throughout David's entire family. So as a result, we have young men, princes of the royal household, who are spoiled and accustomed to having their own way. Because of this, the tragedy between Amnon and his half-sister Tamar will result. Through subtlety and trickery, Amnon feigns illness, and having everyone go out from them demands that Tamar feed him by herself. And under the guise of brotherly love, he takes Tamar by force and rapes her. Tragically, when he has vented his lust, he calls the young men who attend his royal person and commands that she be thrown out of the room and the door locked behind her. And now, this young Israelite woman, a princess, has been shamed and does simply not know where to turn. She puts ashes on her head and she tears her long-sleeved garment and she puts her hand on her head and stumbles away, crying aloud as she went, and Absalom rushes up to her and said, "What's happened?" And discovers that this act of rape and incest has occurred, and he says, "Don't say anything about it. Do not take it to heart. I'll take care of you." So Tamar remained and was desolate in the house of her brother Absalom. Now David did hear of it, and he was very angry, and he should have responded. But now, because of the activity which David has in his life, here is a man who had previously been guilty of lust, adultery, and murder, finds himself in a situation where his own son is guilty of lust and incest and rape. David is paralyzed emotionally because he cannot rebuke his son, because his son will say to him, "Dad, you did the same thing." And oh, if there's any reason for us to keep our lives pure, it's because there may be times when we are called on to counsel and to judge in areas that are very sensitive in nature. And if we have been guilty of these kinds of things ourselves, then we will have a difficult time drawing the difference between black and white, good and evil. And everything begins to take on shades of gray when we are involved in these questionable areas, because we have lost our spirit of discernment. And David is the same way, and he's paralyzed emotionally and cannot take action over this heinous thing that has happened in his own house. He was angry. And now, beginning in verse 22, we see that Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or bad. Absalom took on a neutral attitude, but he feigns neutrality about it. But he hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. And Absalom bides his time. And I'm certain that after 2 years had gone by, that Amnon had completely forgotten the matter. But Absalom had not. Time is so subtle. I believe that after the unnamed prophet and after Samuel had told Eli that God would kill his two sons on the same day, when it did not immediately come to pass, Eli began to shrug it off, and he must have said, "That may have been my imagination, or God has probably changed his mind in the matter." We saw that Agag, the king of the Amalekites, was relieved immediately because he thought death was far from him because he had not been killed immediately. And in the same way, when judgment doesn't fall immediately, people tend to think it's never going to happen. But God dwells in eternity, not in time. And one day, or a dozen days, or a dozen years, makes no difference with God. When the infidel shakes his fist at God and says, if there's a God in heaven, then let him strike me down now and nothing happens, that's no indication that God is not in heaven. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, Psalm 2 says, because it makes no difference with God. If he strikes a man dead now, or if he strikes the man dead 50 years from now, or if the man dies of natural causes 50 years from now, it's quite immaterial, because if he does not repent and be converted, he will end up in hell and eventually the lake of fire, and it doesn't matter to God because God dwells in eternity. So time is very subtle. God's decrees are eternal. And a great deal of time may pass between pronounced judgment and the actual judgment itself. And in a minuscule way, Absalom is doing the same thing. He simply pretends not to pay any attention. But for 2 years he hates him, and for 2 years he plans. And finally, after 2 years, he says in verse 26, let my brother go along with us. And the king said, why should he go with you? But Absalom urges him to go to the sheep shearing. And when he gets Amnon by himself, he has his servants kill him. By the time the story gets back to David, rumors have grown and mushroomed, and David is informed that Absalom has killed all of the king's sons. The first thing that would flash through David's mind is treason. And he assumed now that Absalom is going to attempt to take the throne by force. Of course, Amnon was the only son slain, but David tears his clothes and lays on the ground, and now he is beginning to reap the whirlwind after sowing the wind. And we have lust and incest and rape and now murder within the confines of his own family and among his own sons and his daughter. Verse 5 in chapter 13 told us that Jonadab was the one who devised the subtle and crafty plan whereby Amnon could rape his sister. In chapter 13, verse 32, we are once again introduced to Jonadab, but this time as a two-faced individual. He is the one that comes to the king and said, those were all rumors. Your sons didn't all die. Only Amnon is dead, because Absalom has been determining this since the day he violated his sister Tamar. Now, therefore, don't take the report to heart. All the king's sons are not dead. Only Amnon is dead. And he was the one that devised the plan. What a two-faced individual. Absalom fled because he knew he would not be welcome in Jerusalem. But oh, how David loved Absalom. And verse 37 says, David mourned for his son every day. But the heart of the king longed to go out to Absalom. But he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. I believe what this means is that David is eased somewhat because as long as Amnon was around, he had a monkey on his back. He didn't know what to do. He was paralyzed. He didn't know if he should punish him, if he should go back and reopen old wounds. And I'm sure that not a day went by but what David thought about that incident between Amnon and Tamar and berated himself for not acting more promptly at the time. Now that Amnon is dead, those troubles are over. Through a series of events, as recorded in chapter 14, Absalom became welcome once more back in the land of Jerusalem. After returning, 2 full years went by before Absalom came face to face with his father once again. An interesting sidelight about Absalom is the fact that he was a perfect specimen of a man. In chapter 14, verse 25 says, there was no one as handsome as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. His hair was so heavy at the end of each year when he cut it that it weighed 200 shekels by the king's weight. Do you recall how many shekels the spearhead of Goliath weighed? You're right, 600 shekels, and we determined that it was 15 pounds. The king's weight may have differed slightly, but we know that Absalom had somewhere between 2.5 and 5 pounds of hair. I don't know about you, but I don't think I've ever had 5 pounds of hair. So for many of us, Absalom would cut off enough to go around and cover the bald spots of at least a dozen friends that I know. So he was a handsome man and had a heavy, thick head of hair. Once Absalom comes face to face with his father again, in verse 33, he came to the king and fell down before him, and the king kissed Absalom. Absalom is back in the presence of the king, but unfortunately, he is no sooner back in the presence of the king than he begins to make aspirations toward the throne. Keep in mind that Amnon was the firstborn and, under the dynastic succession of the day, was next in line for the throne. Amnon is dead, Kileab is evidently out of the picture, and Absalom, as the thirdborn, is next in line dynastically for the throne of Israel. By this time, David is beyond middle age. I'm sure that Amnon has convinced himself that he can do a better job as ruler of the nation. With these selfish motivations, and with a humanistic effort outside of the will of God, Amnon begins to plot to take the throne of David by force. This narrative picks up in 2 Samuel chapter 15, beginning in verse 1. Keep in mind that in those days, there were no billboards, no radio, no TV, for the political candidates who were aspiring to office. Only two things remained to do. Number one, as you rode through town, you hired professional runners to run ahead of your chariot. As they ran ahead of your chariot, they would proclaim your name and your deeds and your exploits. This would cause people to look from their windows and see you in the chariot and begin to recognize your face so that when it came time for popular public support, you could count on the people who recognized your appearance. To accomplish this, verse 1 says that Absalom provided 50 runners. Everywhere Absalom went in his chariot, 50 runners were running ahead of him saying, "Absalom the Great, Absalom's the greatest, here comes Absalom, here's Prince Absalom," and all heads would turn toward this handsome man with the full, heavy head of hair. There was probably no more dashing figure or no more handsome figure behind the charioteer than Absalom. And as a charismatic, popular leader of men, he would be number one on the list. Secondly, he used to rise early, verse 2 says, and stand beside the way to the gate. We've learned many times that the gate was the center of political and social activity in the city. It was Lot who eventually ended up at the gate of Sodom and Gomorrah, in a place of political leadership in the city. It was the gate where Boaz negotiated the transaction with the nearest kinsman. And it's at the gate where Absalom encounters the people as they go in and out seeking justice from the king. Unfortunately, Absalom does not only promote himself from the gate, but he poisons the well against King David and his advisors. Absalom says, "Oh, from what city are you, my friend?" And he would say, "Oh, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel. I'm one of you." Then Absalom would say, "I believe that your claims are good and right. You know, you're right. What you've said is true. You have a perfect right to that." And he would totally agree with the problem or the claim or the difficulty that the person coming through the gate would say. And he would say, "But you know, when you get inside the gate here and go see David, no one's going to listen to you in there. No one listens to you on the part of the king. Oh, but that someone would appoint me judge over Israel. If I had that job, every man who had a suit or a cause could come to me and I would give him justice." When these people would come into the gate and they'd look up and they'd recognize Absalom, they knew immediately he was the prince. And they would begin to fall down and prostrate themselves before him. And he would reach down and grab the man's hand and say, "No, no, no. Don't bow down before me. I'm just one of the fellows. and he'd grab him and kiss him. And verse 6 says, in this manner Absalom dealt with all who came to the king for judgment. He poisoned the mind of everyone against the king. And he stood out there in the gate and filtered out the people that would go in to see the king, and did this for evidently a long period of time. As he did this, David became insulated from the problems of the people. Verse 6 says that Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Finally, when he knows that he has turned the minds of the people against the king, he asks his father for permission to go away for a little while to take care of a religious matter at Hebron. And as he goes back to Hebron, verse 10 says, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. I do not think it is coincidental that Absalom goes back to Hebron, because that is the spot where his father David got his beginning. And when Absalom goes back to King David's roots, he believes that he can gather the same kind of support that his father had in the early years. And 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem. They were invited and went innocently. They didn't know anything, so they weren't part of this military coup. In addition, Absalom sends for Ahithophel, David's private counselor. And verse 12 says the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Now a messenger comes from Hebron and says the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And David says, arise and flee, because if we don't get away now, none of us will escape from Absalom. He will kill us all. He'll strike the city with the edge of the sword. David has around him these personal bodyguards and personal friends that are willing to go with him wherever he goes and whatever he chooses to do. The king departs from Jerusalem, but leaves 10 concubines behind. He is accompanied on his journey by his private military guard, the 600 men who had come with him from Gath. I think it's just like the good old days. Even though he's fleeing from Absalom and his heart is heavy, he has not been involved in military activity for a number of years, and I think his heart's beginning to beat just a little faster, and I think his pulse is pounding, because there's something about the thrill of military activity that never quite leaves the system of an old soldier like David. As he's on his way, someone tells him that Ahithophel, his old counselor, is now among the conspirators with Absalom. David lifts his voice up in prayer and says, O Lord, make the counsel of Ahithophel come to nothing or become foolishness. As he continues on his way, Hushai comes to him. His coat is torn. He has dust on his head. And David gives him the job as a counter spy in the military center of operations which Absalom has established. He says, whatever you hear from the king's house, report back to Zadok and Abathar the priests, because they have their two sons with them, and their two sons will send me everything that you hear. David is still an old fox when it comes to military activity, so he establishes this spy network, which will bring information to him by way of Hushai, through Zadok and Abathar, through their sons to David, where he is in exile out of the city of Jerusalem. Jumping to chapter 16, verse 15, the narrative of the invasion of Absalom continues. We read that Absalom and all the people of men of Israel entered Jerusalem with Ahithophel, David's old counselor. Immediately after he enters Jerusalem, Hushai, our double agent, the spy that David has sent, comes up to Absalom and says, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom turns to Hushai and says, is this the kind of loyalty you're showing to your friend? In other words, my father David. Why did you not go with your friend? Hushai says, no, because whoever the Lord and this people have chosen, his will I be, and with him will I remain. And besides, why should I not serve in the presence of his son? As I have served in your father's presence, so I will be in your presence. So Hushai, the double agent, is waxing eloquent as he convinces Absalom of his loyalty to him. Absalom turns aside to Ahithophel and says, "Give me your advice. What should we do?" Ahithophel says to Absalom, "Go and take those 10 concubines that your father left and have sexual relations with them up on the roof in front of everybody." In a manner of speaking, this was incest, but under the principle that we discussed before, which Abner practiced with the concubine of Saul, it was Absalom's way of saying, "I am now the king because I am claiming for my own the concubines of the former king who is now in exile." Not only did that make Absalom odious in the sight of his father David, but it let all the people see that he was making formal claim to the throne, since he now took the former king's concubines as his own. In chapter 17, Absalom continues to receive advice from Ahithophel. The advice that Ahithophel gave in verse 1 is good advice for Absalom, because he says, "Take 12,000 men and let's chase David down, and I'll come upon him while he's tired and exhausted. We'll terrify him and we'll terrify those few people. We'll strike him down, and I personally will strike down the king by myself," Ahithophel says. Now that's a good kind of old friend to have, one that's ready to take your life later on when the tables are turned. He also promises to bring the people back who have accompanied David. The plan pleased Absalom. Can you imagine this wicked man being pleased by a plan that includes the murder of his own father? Absalom is not quite sure about the advice which Ahithophel has given, so he calls Hushai and says, "Let us hear what he has to say." Hushai is advised by Absalom about the plan which Ahithophel has given. Hushai knows that this is good advice, good for Absalom, but bad for his master David. Hushai, as the perfect double agent, says, "That's bad advice. David and his men are mighty men, and when you threaten them in that way, when you back them up in a corner, they'll be like a bear robbed of her cubs. He's an expert in warfare. He's probably even now hidden in one of the caves, and whoever hears of it is going to say, Absalom's men have failed in their attempt to take him, and their hearts will melt, and you will lose the support of the people." He said, "I advise you that you personally go into battle against David. Take everybody that you can, so the people are numbered like the sand of the sea. And we're going to find him and fall on him as dew falls on the ground. And if he goes into a city, we'll tear the walls down and go in and get him." And Absalom and all the men of Israel said in verse 14, "This is better counsel than Ahithophel gave." But we read that the Lord had ordained to thwart the good or sound logical counsel of Ahithophel in order that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. Isn't it wonderful that this inspired word of God has more intrigue and action, military activity and subterfuge than any TV show you could see or any novel you could buy? In accordance with David's earlier instructions, we read in verse 15 that Hushai takes a message to Zadok and Abiathar and tells them what Ahithophel counseled. They pass the word on to a maidservant. A maidservant takes the message down to the two sons of the priests, and they are going to go and tell King David, because no one could see the sons of the priest entering the city, or they would know what they were up to. But a lad did see them in verse 18, and he goes and tells Absalom. So they departed quickly to the house of a man who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down in the well, and the man took a covering and spread some grass all over the top and camouflaged the mouth of the well. So when Absalom's servants came and said, "Where are the sons of those priests?" the woman said, "They've crossed the water. They went that way." They searched and couldn't find them and returned to Jerusalem. It came about after they had departed, they came up out of the well and they ran and told David and said, "Ahithophel has counseled against you." With this information, David rises and crosses the Jordan. Ahithophel sees that Absalom is not going to heed his counsel. He senses that tragedy is going to occur because his counsel was not followed. He saddles his donkey, sets his house in order, and strangled himself. He committed suicide because he knew Absalom's defeat was imminent. He knew that he had betrayed his old friend. He knew now and sensed that God's hand was against Absalom, and he commits suicide. Absalom continues to pursue David. He has replaced Joab as commander-in-chief with Joab's cousin. And as he continues to pursue David, David goes to Mahanaim. It is at this point that David's previous political savvy begins to pay off. Recall that back in chapter 12, verses 29 through 31, following the attack on Rabbah and the sons of Ammon, David did not slaughter them as he usually did. He put them to work. Now he runs into the son of Nahash from Rabbah, the sons of Ammon, in Mahanaim. Since he did not slaughter his relatives before, this man now shows kindness to David and gives David provision as he flees from his son Absalom. In addition, you will notice that the man that Mephibosheth lived with is also there. And since David had showed kindness to him before back in 2 Samuel 9:4, he receives kindness in return because these individuals bring him beds and basins and pottery, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, honey, everything that David needs to eat and for the people that are with him. David sees now that he has to fight. The time for flight is over, and the time for fight is at hand. He takes the men that are with him in chapter 18, verse 1, and sets one-third under Joab, one-third under Joab's brother Abishai, and one-third under Ittai the Gittite. Now, with the thrill of battle coursing through his veins, once again, David says, I'm going with you, but the people all said, you shall not go out. Because they don't care about us. Even if half of us die, they won't care, but you are worth 10,000 of us. So David stays behind in Mahanaim. He will wait by the gate to receive news of the battle. He instructs his three generals to deal kindly with the young man Absalom, indicating that his ill-founded, ill-proportioned, warped love for his evil son is beginning to take precedence over his love for God's kingdom, and his love for God's people. This is the end.